Good morning. I've had a good love affair. Can you hear me? A good love affair with Booker T. Washington for some years. It's good in the way that you begin to understand these things at my age rather than in my youth, which is to say, I guess it's the flip side of why John Kerry won't be elected president, by the way. The more you get to see him, of him, the more you hear him, the less you like him. You know what I mean? The reverse is true with Washington. The more you get to see him, the more you have conversations with him, the more you listen to him, the more you like him. Washington was a self-made man, of course. We all know this. His book, Up from Slavery, has never been out of print since its publication. He liked self-made men. He liked Lincoln in part because he thought Lincoln was a self-made man, and because what that means in part is not only making yourself in the material and economic sense, but as he put it of Lincoln, Lincoln unfettered himself from all the prejudices and the unnatural thoughts and acts that men are heir to. He said of Frederick, Washington said of Frederick Douglass that he was, of course, a self-made man as well, and he led our people in the period of revolution and liberation. Now, Washington himself thought that in the end he was leading his people during a period of construction and readjustment. Now, this is a man who, to remind ourselves very quickly, Washington founded the Tuskegee Institute on 4th of July, 1881. Of course, there was nothing there. He had gotten a $2,000 subvention from the legislature. It was a deal cut between an ex-slave owner and the local black guy. The ex-slave owner was running for the state legislature, and he wanted some black support, so they cut a deal. And when Washington got there, he had $2,000 to pay salary, but no buildings, and eventually, quickly, 30 students. Now, what Lawrence Dunbar called this most political man who was able to wield a secret stiletto, this Booker T. Washington, by his death, November 14, 1915, this teacher, he called himself a teacher above all. Let's remember, Tuskegee had 2,000 students in 1915, $2 million endowment, 2,000 acres, 100 buildings, almost every single one of them built by the students and the teachers themselves, staffed by blacks. It's the first institution to be staffed entirely by blacks. Its majority of its graduates were teachers. Washington wrote 10 books. He thought himself to be a teacher of not only Negroes, but of whites, which opinion, of course, he didn't reveal the full implications of the fact that he thought he was a teacher not only of blacks but of whites as well at every place and every opportunity for understandable reasons. He thought, in short, that he was a teacher of former slaves and slave owners as well as so in other words, put it differently, he said northern whites, southern whites, and blacks. And he had to speak in a way, and I'm quoting him, that would gain the interest and sympathy of all three classes directly concerned. Not a small rhetorical task for this statesman. He wanted to, as he put it, enter sympathetically into the three different points of view entertained by those three classes. I, he says, have had to consider in detail how the work that I was trying to do was going to affect the interests of all three. Washington's work was always circumscribed by two massive facts, in my opinion, each of which he had to consider in all his purposes and actions. First, because of slavery, blacks found themselves in a primitive condition and were weak. And second, whites were not only prejudiced against blacks, but were also strong. While Washington insisted that everyone, black and white, live up to what he called the American standard, he acknowledged that, quote, my race must continue passing through the severe American crucible, unquote. So the heart of Washington's political thought and statesmanship, its greatness and its possible defect, lay in this twofold approach of emphasizing that the black man in the South must begin at the bottom and of de-emphasizing the injustice of being placed there. In his attempt to promote and speak for the black race, he tried to shape public sentiment by tying together the destiny of the two races, always claiming that the prosperity and well-being of one was directly connected to the prosperity and well-being of the other. He attempted to, and I quote him, cement a friendship between the two races that shall be manly, honorable, and permanent, unquote. The solution that he proposed was not a political solution, as that is ordinarily understood. Certainly not a politics that emphasized, at least in public, the demand for civil rights. Rather, it was a solution based on interest and economics. Yet, Washington made it clear that, quote, the Negro has always been true to the Stars and Stripes and the best interests of the nation, unquote. And that all that the Negro asks is that the door, I'm quoting again, that the door which rewards industry, thrift, intelligence, and character be left as wide open for him as for the foreigner who constantly comes to our country. You can see why I enjoy this conversation with this guy. More than this, Washington continues, he has no right to request. Less than this, a republic has no right to vouchsafe, unquote. Although he started with an emphasized necessity and interest, Washington's end or purpose was moral or political, to bring about a free society that did not recognize color as a bar to any achievement. Yet in his attempt to increase the sympathy between the races, he was obliged to consider both the sentiments of Southern whites as well as the harsh political realities in the South after the collapse of Reconstruction, both of which seemed to make the possibility of full citizenship for blacks only a distant goal. And in doing this, consistently throughout his life, he was careful to allow those whites who were impressed by his conciliatory language to confuse his means for his ends. Washington was a thoughtful man of action, I submit, who in trying to untie the Gordian knot of race, as one scholar put it, effectively masked the ultimate implications of his philosophy. Consequently, whites were pleased and supportive with the pressing projects he was involved in because they did not see that in the end, Washington would also try to become their teacher. He effectively molded public sentiment on behalf of American blacks by addressing their predicament through stressing their obligations rather than their rights, and by arguing that the national race problem will be solved in the South. In doing this, he was willing to acquiesce to the majority's demand that there be racial separation in social life, yet he always argued that blacks are Americans, a part of a great whole, a part of what he called our complex American civilization. His rhetoric reveals that he was conscious of the ineradicable fact that blacks needed the support of whites and that there was a price for that support. He was willing to pay that price, not only because he thought he had to, but also because it was good for his people to do so. I repeat, he thought it was good for his people to pay that price. I suspect that he thought he would be successful because he thought that through his own virtue and the virtues of his own people, manifested in both speech and deed, he would be able eventually to persuade all Americans that blacks should be given the opportunity to live up to the American standard and to be incorporated as citizens. He assumed that merit or moral excellence would count. In the end, perhaps ironically, his authority, political power, and sophisticated rhetoric waned because other blacks, claiming that Washington gave up too much or his way was too difficult, took up the political argument directly and wielded a sword against this knot. Now, Washington understands that he's not speaking in abstractions here, that he's speaking about practical matters, and that you have to start with slavery. This institution, which of course he was a participant, was a curse to both races. And I quote him as the challenge that he sets out for himself and his enterprise, quote, "The greatest injury that slavery did to my people was to deprive them of the sense of self-dependence, habit of economy, and executive power, which are the glory and distinction of the Anglo-Saxon race. There is no short-term solution to such a problem," he maintains. He was distraught over the fact that ex-slaves wanted to learn Greek and Latin, hold political office, and become preachers. This was a problem. They misunderstood. What blacks had to do, that is to say, ex-slaves had to do, ironically, if not horribly, was to learn to work, and not Greek and Latin. One of the worst sights he ever saw in his life, he says, is a young man, a former slave, sitting on a dunghill in misery and dirt and filth, trying to master French grammar. Washington argued that there was a great difference between being worked and working. Being worked as slaves was degrading, obviously, but working as free men meant civilization. The greatest lesson, he says, which we wanted to learn in freedom was to work. He stated that the greatest thing that, quote, we have accomplished for the Negro race within the last 25 years, he was saying this in about 1907, has been to rid his mind of all idea of labor's being degrading. This has been no inconsiderable achievement, unquote. Washington noticed that this is not a tangible physical change, but a change of the spirit. At first, the free men only wanted to work long enough to satisfy their immediate wants, and they could not understand why it was necessary to work any longer. Although Washington admitted that there's a good deal of human nature in this point of view, he argued that it is good to teach men to become more ambitious. I quote him again, "We should get the family to the point where it will want money to educate its children, to support the ministers and the church," unquote. When families will have reached this point, they will no longer work just a few days a week, they will work six. This is what Washington calls the movement from necessity to civilization, built on the natural connection between labor and property. A person who works is entitled to the fruits of his labor. And as a man moves towards what might be called luxury in his accumulation of property, he will see that the purpose of that work and that property is beyond simply what we would call material accumulation. As it were, then he could study Greek and Latin. The purpose, this purpose has always been called civilization, or if you like, leisure. But Washington reminded his audience always that not only were blacks starting at the bottom, they were doing it in the midst of a pushing, surging, restless, conquering, and very successful civilization. But of course, blacks will not be confined to the farm or the trades. But if a black man succeeded such work, Washington was confident that at the very least, he could lay the foundations upon which his children and grandchildren could grow to higher and more important things in life. Thus it was not surprising when Washington stated, and I quote, "I consider labor one of the greatest boons which our Creator has conferred upon human beings," unquote. But I must emphasize that Washington also noted that the whole machinery of slavery had a similar effect on white people. Labor was looked upon by them as a badge of degradation, of inferiority. Hence, labor was something for both races on the slave plantation that sought to escape. The slave system, quoting Washington, "in large measure took the spirit of self-reliance and self-help out of the white people," unquote. Washington often noted that if people complain of the black man's morals, they should keep in mind that, quote, He has had no standard by which to shape his character. He has had no standard by which to shape his character, unquote. This is a damning remark on those so-called civilized whites with whom the blacks, as slaves and then as freemen, came into contact. The whites provided no standard for virtue and morality. They never ruled slaves with the intention of preparing them in any way for freedom because they did not understand freedom. The black man, consequently, will have to shape his own character, and he will have to make himself free. Washington calls Lincoln the emancipator of America, not the emancipator of blacks, because he freed not only the black man, but also the white man. Although the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation was a great event, it was a symbol to Washington of another still greater and more momentous. I quote, "We who celebrate this anniversary should not forget that the same pen that gave freedom to 4 millions of African slaves at the same time struck the shackles from the souls of 27 millions of Americans of another color," unquote. But Washington argued that although slavery was manifestly unjust, it also became a kind of school for blacks, where they were ironically given instruction in freedom in the highest form of citizenship. The fact that the black man was brought to the New World against his will and in chains indicates to Washington that he was in need. I'm panicking here. That he was in need. Sorry, Misugi, you're a rude man.
Agreed.
Yeah. Just about to reach my rhetorical heights, and he hands me a slip of paper that says, "Shut up." The fact that the black man was brought to the New World against his will and in chains indicates to Washington that he was needed. He helped to make the country, and especially the South, rich and prosperous. Furthermore, he had not only survived over two centuries of toil, but the black man prospered. Not only had his numbers increased, but also, quote, "he has made steady gain in acquiring property, skill, habits of industry, education, and a Christian character," unquote. As Washington said, the black man had looked the white man in the face and survived. Quoting Washington, "I know that almost every other race that tried to look the white man in the face has disappeared," unquote. A race that was capable of being thus tested, a race that was capable of being thus transformed, was worth, quote, "making a part in reality as well as in name of our democratic government," unquote. Now, I'll conclude because I'm really going on too long. This is not a small matter for Washington. This is a serious matter that has universal implications, despite the fact that we're over slavery as that has traditionally been understood. If you don't know exactly what Washington means by this character building and this education of hand, heart, and head that he talks about, and how he wants his people to emancipate himself, then I suggest you spend some time with 17-year-old boys and girls who lack those kinds of habits that Washington think is necessary for liberty rightly understood. Washington seemed to be a humble man who was in fact, I think, in the end, arrogant and had good reason to be. He tried to be the teachers of both whites and blacks, which means of all Americans, and arguably, he has not yet failed. Thank you very much.